Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 199. It's Monday, February 20th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's get to it. First up, from the Washington Post, teen girls engulfed in violence and trauma, CDC finds. Teen girls across the United States are engulfed in a growing wave of violence and trauma, according to federal researchers who released data showing increases in rape and sexual violence, as well as record levels of feeling sad and hopeless. Nearly one in three high school girls reported in 2021 that they seriously considered suicide, up nearly 60% from a decade ago, according to new findings from the CDC. Almost 15% of teen girls have said they were forced to have sex, an increase of 27% over 2 years, and the first increase since CDC began tracking it. If you think about every 10 girls that you know, at least one and possibly more has been raped, and that is the highest level we've ever seen, said Kathleen Ethier, director of the CDC's Division of Adolescent and School Health, who said the rise of sexual violence almost certainly contributed to the glaring spike of depressive symptoms. We are really alarmed, she said. Ethier said it's important to determine who is perpetuating the violence, which the survey did not address, and how it can be stopped. Almost 3 in 5 teenage girls reported feeling so persistently sad or hopeless almost every day for at least 2 weeks in a row during the previous year that they stopped regular activities, a figure that was double the share of boys and the highest in a decade. Girls fared worse on other measures, too. The higher rates of alcohol and drug use than boys and higher levels of being electronically bullied, according to the 89-page report, 13% had attempted suicide during the past year, compared with 7% of boys. Sharon Hoover, professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and co-director of the National Center for School Mental Health, said she was struck by the magnitude of the increases and the gender difference. Hoover and others pointed out it is unclear whether the data is influenced by other factors. If girls were more aware of depressive symptoms than boys, for instance, or more inclined to report them, or whether girls are simply far worse off. CDC researchers said schools could be a lifeline as students struggle, pointing to studies showing better mental health outcomes for students who feel connected to their schools. The pandemic took a heavy toll on adolescents who already struggled with depression, anxiety, and thoughts of suicide before it began. Many were cooped up at home for months. They continue to struggle with social media pressures, academic strain, and family turmoil. Some lost parents and other relatives to COVID-19. This data make it clear that young people in the U.S. are collectively experiencing a level of distress that calls on us to act, the report said. CDC researchers have kept an eye on data about forced sex for a long time, Ethier said. Now we see this increase from 11% to 14% of teenage girls saying that they've been raped just between 2019 and 2021. That's extremely concerning, she said. These data show a distressing picture, said Deborah Horry, the CDC's chief medical officer, speaking at a briefing. Americans' teen girls are engulfed in a growing wave of sadness, violence, and trauma. This was not completely a surprise for Lori McGarry Close, past president of the National Association of School Psychologists. The first thing that came to mind about the rise in depressive symptoms, she said, was that this is hard data that shows what we've known anecdotally for the last couple of years. Teens were hit hard by isolation and disruption of the pandemic. But many were also shaken by a series of high-profile cases of racial injustice, Close said, as they simultaneously navigated personal and family difficulties. It was trauma after trauma, especially for kids of color, she said. The report showed disparities by race and ethnicity. Black and Hispanic students were more likely than white and Asian students to avoid school because of safety concerns, a finding the author said suggested exposure to violence in the community or at school. Black students were more likely to attempt suicide than Asian, Hispanic, or white students. White students were more likely to experience sexual violence than Asian, Black, or Hispanic students, and they were the only group to see an increase in it. American Indian or Alaskan Native high school students were more likely than other groups who have been raped. The report also spotlighted some positive findings. Students reported less alcohol and drug use. Over the last decade, fewer students reported ever having sex, currently having sex, or having had four or more partners during their lifetime. Though usage was significantly down over a decade, girls were more likely than boys to have consumed alcohol and used marijuana during the past 30 days. They were also more likely to have recently vaped or ever used illicit drugs such as cocaine, heroin, inhalants, meth, and hallucinogens. Girls were almost twice as likely as boys to be electronically bullied through texting and social media. The targets of bullying were more likely to be white, American Indian or Alaskan Native, or LGBTQ+. In its report, the CDC steered attention to the nation's schools, saying activities there can make a profound difference in the lives of teens. It recommended improved access to mental health services, more classroom management training for teachers, school clubs that foster gay-straight alliances, high-quality health education, and enforcement of anti-harassment policies. Ideally, schools would take on multiple initiatives. The more of these things you do, the better the impact on the school environment, Ethier said. Research shows that those who feel close to people at school have a significantly lower prevalence of serious thoughts of suicide and feelings of persistent sadness or hopelessness. Our research has shown that young people who feel more connected in their schools do better, both while they're adolescents and up to 20 years later, Ethier said. And, of course, many of these kids end up in the emergency room for mental health crises, and that relates to this next story by CNN. Almost half of children who go to ER with mental health crisis don't get the follow-up care they need, study finds. Every night that Jennifer Hoffman works as an attending physician at the pediatric ER, she says at least one child comes in with a mental or behavioral health emergency. Over the span of her career, she's seen the number of young people needing help grow enormously. The most common problems I see are children with suicidal thoughts or children with severe behavior problems, where they may be at risk of harm to themselves or others, said Hoffman, who works at the Children's Hospital of Chicago. We're also seeing younger children, especially since the pandemic started. Children as young as 8, 9, or 10 years old are coming to the emergency department with mental health concerns. It's just mind-blowing. The surge of children turning up in emergency departments with mental health issues was a challenge even before 2020, but rates soared during the COVID-19 pandemic, studies show. ER staffers may be able to stabilize a child in a mental health crisis, but research has shown that timely follow-up with a provider is key to their success long-term. Unfortunately, there just doesn't seem to be enough of it, according to a new study co-authored by Hoffman. Without the proper follow-up, these children too often wound up back in the ER. For their study, published in the journal Pediatrics, Hoffman and her co-authors looked at records of more than 28,000 children aged 6 to 17 years old who were enrolled in Medicaid and had at least one trip to the emergency department between January 2018 and June 2019. They found that less than a third of the children had the benefit of an outpatient mental health visit within 7 days of being discharged from the ER. A little more than 55% had a follow-up within 30 days. Research has shown that follow-up with a mental health care provider lowers a person's suicide risk, raises the chance that they will take their prescription medicine, and decreases the chance that they will make repeated trips to the ER. The new study found that without follow-up, more than a quarter of the children had to go back to the ER for additional mental health care within 6 months of their initial visit. The emergency department is a safety net. It's always open, but there's a limited extent to the type of mental health service we can provide in that setting, Hoffman said. This really speaks to inadequate access to services that these kids need. The dynamic can be devastating for parents and emergency department staff alike, she said. We know what a child needs, but we're just not able to schedule follow-up due to shortages among the mental health profession. They're widespread in the U.S., she said. A lack of professional help is a problem for many children. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the CDC found that 1 in 5 children had a mental health disorder, but only about 20% got care from a mental health provider. Children's mental health had become such a concern in the U.S. that the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and the Children's Hospital Association declared a national emergency in 2021. Hoffman's study found that Black children fared worse than their peers. they were 10% less likely to have timely follow-up than white children. Remember, that was on the order of 55% or less. So it's, it's more, it depends how you look at it. It's more than 20% worse than white children as a proportion, which is very concerning given that there are many disparities in access of care to our mental health system, Hoffman said. Black children are more likely to live in neighborhoods that have shortages of mental health professionals. There's also limited diversity among the mental health workforce. Studies show that nearly 84% of psychologists are white, as are nearly 65% of counselors and more than 60% of social workers. And black children more often rely on school-based mental health services. Although the number of school counselors has been increasing over the years, few schools meet the National Association of School Psychologists' recommended ratio of one school psychologist to 500 students. The national ratio for the 2021-22 year school year was 1,127 to 1 versus the 500 to 1, the association found. The new study found that children who did not have mental health before their ER visit had the most difficulty finding timely care afterwards. The lack of providers who can do follow-up is a real source of concern. It's not ideal to hand a phone number to a parent and hope they can arrange care. It often takes weeks or even months to get a first appointment with a child or adolescent psychiatrist. This new analysis adds to the overwhelming evidence that there is an urgent need for dramatic change in our pediatric mental health care system, the accompanying commentary says. We believe it is time for a child mental health moonshot and call on the field and its funders to come together to launch the next wave of bold mental health research for the benefit of these children and their families who so desperately need our support.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, I want to do a couple COVID-19 stories. Looks like this next story from the Philadelphia Inquirer gets at the fact that we may be stuck in a holding pattern with COVID-19 for quite a while. We've been having hundreds of people die each day from COVID-19 for months and months and months now, and it looks like that pattern may persist. Okay, the article. Unless most people get an annual COVID vaccine, tens of thousands will die in the U.S. each year, a Penn State team finds. Public health experts warned from the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic that the disease was, quote, not like the flu, resulting in far more deaths and hospitalizations each year. Unless most people get annual booster shots, that grim tide is not going to let up anytime soon, a new Pennsylvania State University study finds. Just under half of the people in the United States got a dose of vaccine in 2022, and if the annual vaccination rate stays at that level for the next decade, between 89,000 and 120,000 people will die of COVID each year, the authors projected. To drive the annual number of deaths down below 10,000, at least 68 to 84% of people would need to get an annual shot, they found. If we don't change our current COVID management strategy, then we're going to expect every year to see twice as many deaths as we would see from a very bad flu season, said epidemiologist Joseph Servadio, one of the authors. The FDA recently proposed that the COVID vaccine be updated annually, but a yearly shot may be a hard sell, given that just 16% of people have gotten the latest booster since it became available in late August. For many months, the daily number of COVID deaths has remained stubbornly in the hundreds, and there's no sign it's going down anytime soon, said another author of the new study. It seems that we have surrendered to COVID and decided this death toll is fine. The message I take from this paper is that COVID is not over and has not become a typical upper respiratory infection like the flu. Today, COVID mortality is more concentrated among patients with risk factors, which makes it less palpable to many Americans. but the numbers do not lie. We are losing tens and even hundreds of thousands of people to this disease. We will continue to do so if we minimize the risks and lose folks and focus on vaccination. The Penn State team projected annual COVID cases, hospitalizations, and death for a variety of scenarios. Among the variables was the degree of virus transmissibility in the future. The projection of 89,000 to 120,000 deaths was based on the assumption that the virus would continue to spread at the current rate. The authors projected different totals for other scenarios in which the virus becomes more or less transmissible. The model was also based on the latest figures for the risk of COVID hospitalization and death in various age groups if they do not receive treatment with the antiviral drug. For example, the risk of hospitalization was effectively zero for children under 10, 3.8% for adults in their 50s, and 24% for those aged 80 and up. And in yet another reminder that avoiding COVID can prevent future problems, this from Medical Express. COVID-19 survivors may have higher risk of developing diabetes. COVID-19 survivors have a 66% higher risk of developing type 1 or type 2 diabetes following their diagnosis compared with those not diagnosed with COVID-19, according to a study by Penn State College of Medicine researchers. Their findings are among the latest evidence suggesting that people diagnosed with COVID-19 may experience a range of health issues in the time period following their illness. Okay, well, next up, let's turn to a story about vaping and smoking, this from Medical Express. DNA damage levels similar in vapers and smokers, study finds. E-cigarettes used regularly by more than 10% of U.S. teens and more than 3% of adults were once pitched as a healthy alternative to tobacco cigarettes, but research increasingly links the use of e-cigarettes or vaping to many of the same life-threatening diseases that plague smokers. In a breakthrough study, a group of researchers from the School of Medicine at USC analyzed epithelial cells taken from the mouths of vapers, smokers, and people who had never vaped or smoked. They found that vapers and smokers had similar levels of DNA damage, more than twice the amount found in non-users. DNA damage was higher among those who vaped or smoked more frequently. It was also higher in vapers who used vape pods and mods, as well as sweet, fruit, or mint-flavored vapes. For the first time, we showed that the more vapers used e-cigarettes and the longer they used them, the more DNA damage occurred in their oral cells, said Amma Besaratinia, professor of research population and public health sciences at the School of Medicine, and the study's senior author. The same pattern held up for smokers. DNA damage to oral epithelial cells, which line the mouth, is an early change that is associated with increased risk for many types of chronic disease, including cancer and inflammatory diseases. The findings are highly relevant for public health agencies and regulators who aim to keep dangerous products away from vulnerable groups, including children and adolescents. The most popular products, including flavored vapes, which are used by about 85% of teens who do vape, also appear to be the most harmful in terms of producing DNA damage. So, yeah, while there was hopes that maybe vaping wouldn't be as dangerous as smoking, doesn't look like that's really the case. Well, if you or somebody you know is interested in smoking, you can call the Ohio Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW for assistance and resources. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Okay, well, next up, I have a story about smoke, but a different kind of smoke, this wildfire smoke. This is from NBC News. As little as one day of wildfire smoke exposure in pregnancy may raise risk of preterm birth. A study of more than 2.5 million pregnant people in California found that those exposed to wildfire smoke for at least one day faced a higher risk of giving birth prematurely. The results suggested that just one day of smoke exposure slightly raised the risk of spontaneous preterm birth, defined as before the 37th week of pregnancy. But the odds of preterm birth increased by 0.3% with each additional day of smoke exposure. Most pregnant persons are having well over one day of exposure, and the chronicity of this exposure, which continues to increase, is really the worrisome relationship with wildfire smoke, said Dr. Ann Waldrop, the study's lead author and maternal fetal medicine fellow at Stanford University. Waldrop's team estimated that 86% of pregnant people studied in California had been exposed to fine particulate matter from wildfire smoke during their first or second trimesters, or during the 4 weeks leading up to conception. On average, the study participants were exposed to more than 7 days of smoke during that time. Not all smoke exposures are these dramatic smoke and smoke-filled days, Waldrop said. Most likely, a lot of these people didn't recognize the days that they were being exposed. Since smoke from fires in the West can travel thousands of miles, she added, it's not an isolated issue with the Western United States anymore. Dr. Leonardo Trasande, a pediatrics professor at New York University who researches children's environmental health, said the risk of preterm birth could worsen over time as wildfires become more frequent and more intense. Insofar as wildfires are a byproduct of climate change, it's common sense to put two and two together and ultimately relate preterm births to climate change, he said. Trasande's own research is focused on the link between air pollution and preterm births. He previously estimated that nearly 16,000 preterm births in the U.S. in 2010 alone were attributable to exposure to air pollution. On a global scale, another analysis found that air pollution likely contributed to nearly 6 million premature births in 2019. Rakesh Ghosh, the author of that analysis and an epidemiologist at the University of California, San Francisco, said that the exposure to wildfire smoke during the first trimester can cause the amniotic sac to rupture early due to inflammation. Premature birth is a risk factor for death in the first 28 days to 1 year of an infant's life. Research also suggests that preterm birth can be associated with developmental delays in childhood. There is actually now data to suggest that wildfire smoke pollutants can be more biologically active and worse for human health than other forms of pollutants, she said. Aside from leaving an area where there's wildfire smoke or staying indoors with an air filter running, it's difficult to avoid exposure, health experts said. N95 masks may help prevent high levels of exposure, Ghosh said, though experts disagree as to how effective masks can be in smoky air. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Next up, from the Hill, Americans' dissatisfaction with gun laws at new high, says Gallup poll. A majority of Americans surveyed expressed dissatisfaction with current gun laws in the U.S. amid a recent string of mass shootings affecting the country, according to a new Gallup poll. The poll, published last Wednesday, found that 63% of respondents said they are dissatisfied with the nation's laws and policies on firearms, while 34% of those surveyed said the opposite. The results mark the highest percentage of Americans that are dissatisfied with current gun laws in the last 7 years, with a 7-point increase from last year, when 56% of respondents claimed they were unhappy. Satisfaction with gun policies in the country have also fallen since last year's poll, tying the lowest on record, according to Gallup. Among political party lines, 54% of Republican or Republican-leaning independent respondents said they are satisfied with the nation's laws and policies on handguns, while 44% of those surveyed expressed their dissatisfaction with current law. On the other side, 84% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents expressed their dissatisfaction with the nation's laws and policies, while 14% of those surveyed said they are satisfied with the nation's current gun policies. Around 60% of independent respondents expressed their dissatisfaction with the nation's laws and firearm policies, while 36% of those surveyed said they are satisfied. Sounds like time for a change. And next up, another story related to violence, although this is about violence producing a much different outcome. This from Medical Express. Decades of conflict in Iraq have fueled catastrophic rise in antibiotic resistance, warn experts. Decades of war and conflict in Iraq have led to a catastrophic rise in antibiotic resistance in the country, with serious implications for the entire region and the world, warn international experts in the open-access journal BMJ Global Health. The combination of destroyed healthcare infrastructure, medicine shortages, limited resources, high levels of heavy metal contamination, and poor sanitation is likely to blame, they argue. Antibiotic resistance, or AMR for short, is rising globally at an alarming rate and is expected to cause 10 million deaths a year by 2050 if nothing is done about it, point out the authors. Largely attributed to the overuse and misuse of antibiotics, attention is now turning to other factors such as heavy metals and disinfectants containing quaternary ammonium compounds, which are widely used in the healthcare and hospitality sectors. War has been implicated in the emergence of antibiotic resistance as far back as the 1940s, but has received little attention, says the authors. Iraq is a stellar example of this neglect, as the country has experienced a sequence of conflicts since the 1980s that have coincided with the emergence and spread of pathogens with specific patterns of antibiotic resistance. Taken together, a destroyed health infrastructure, inappropriate microbial therapies, limited resources, high heavy metal contamination in humans and the environment, and lack of proper water sanitation and hygiene combined likely play instrumental roles in the catastrophic rise of antibiotic resistance in Iraq, and by extension, regionally and globally, the authors write. Okay, well, let's switch gears and do some nutrition-related stories. Got five of them queued up here. First up, from NBC News, high sugar intake linked to elevated risk of heart disease and stroke, study finds. A study released last Monday offers even more evidence of the harmful effects of sugar. The research published in the journal BMC Medicine found that diets higher in free sugars, a category that includes sugar added to processed foods and sodas, as well as that found in fruit juice and syrups, raises one risk of heart disease and stroke. Sugars that occur naturally in whole fruits and vegetables are not considered free sugars and were excluded from the analysis. So we've known for a long time that added sugars are not good for our health, but this study, what it really adds is that it also included a big category of like fruit juice. And even when you include fruit juice in the analysis, it shows this elevated risk of heart disease and stroke. You have to remember that most fruit juices are very highly processed, very high in sugar, and removes most of the nutrients that were originally present in the fruit. Okay, next up from Medical Express, survey finds cost of healthy food biggest barrier to heart-healthy diet. According to a new Cleveland Clinic survey, 46% of Americans believe the cost of healthy food is the biggest barrier to a heart-healthy diet. A heart-healthy diet is a cornerstone of how we lower the risk of cardiovascular disease, says Leslie Cho, cardiologist for Cleveland Clinic. It's really sad that in our economic times, people feel that eating heart-healthy is more expensive. Dr. Cho said buying healthier foods like fruits and vegetables doesn't have to be expensive. For example, you don't need to buy organic. As long as you eat the rainbow of colors in your fruits and vegetables, that's good for you and your cardiovascular health, she explained. The survey also found that some are unclear on which diets are the healthiest for their hearts. In fact, 10% chose a fast food diet as the most heart healthy, with parents being two times more likely to choose it. In addition, 45% polled admitted they buy fast food at least once a week. And in other findings from that study about what the biggest barriers to American healthy eating, so the top was 46% viewed healthy food as expensive, 23% lack time to prepare healthy meals, and 20% don't know how to cook healthy food. So there you go. Okay, well, let's get to some good news in our nutrition series here. This from Medical Express. Study hints healthier school lunch can reduce obesity. A 2010 federal law that boosted nutrition standards for school meals may have begun to help slow the rise of obesity among America's children, even teenagers who can buy their own snacks, a new study showed. The national study found a small but significant decline in the average body mass index of more than 14,000 school kids aged 5 to 18 whose weights and heights were tracked before and after implementation of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. The study is new evidence that improving the quality of school meals through legislation might be one way to help shift the trajectory of childhood obesity, which has been rising for decades and now affects about 1 in 5 U.S. kids. Whether the program has begun to turn the tide for the whole country and not just a group of kids studied is still unclear. About 30 million children in the U.S. receive school lunches each day. You have the potential to really impact their excess weight gain over the course of their entire childhood, said Dr. Aruna Chandran, a social epidemiologist with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, who led this study published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics. The Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010, championed by former First Lady Michelle Obama, was the first national legislation to improve school meals in more than 20 years. It increased the quantity of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains required in school meals. One way to think of the change is that a 10-year-old boy with an elevated body mass index, the decline would amount to about 1 pound weight loss, noted Dr. Lauren Feichner, director of nutrition at Mass General Hospital for Children in Boston, who wrote an editorial accompanying the study. This is important as even BMI flattening over time is likely important, she said. Holding kids' weights steady as they grow can help keep obesity in check. Previous studies have shown weight-related effects of the federal law among children from low-income families. The new study is the first to find lower BMI in kids across all income levels. At the same time, significant decreases in BMI measured were seen not only in kids age 5 to 11, but also in kids age 12 to 18. That's an incredible shift, Chandran said. These are kids who potentially have their own autonomy to buy their own snacks. These new results come within days of the release of updated standards for school meals, including the first limits on added sugars, decrease sodium, and increase flexibility for whole grains. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the study shows that healthy school meals are, quote, critical for tackling diet-related conditions like obesity. Okay, well, next up, let's look at a story about nutrition in our youngest folks, infants. This from The Lancet. Unveiling the predatory tactics of the formula milk industry. For decades, the commercial milk formula industry has used underhanded marketing strategies designed to prey on patients' fears and concerns at a vulnerable time to turn the feeding of young children into a multi-billion dollar business. The immense economic power accrued by the commercial milk formula manufacturers is deployed politically to ensure the industry is under-regulated and services supporting breastfeeding are under-resourced. These are the stark findings of the 2023 breastfeeding series published in The Lancet. The three-paper series outlines how typical infant behaviors such as crying, fussiness, and poor nighttime sleep are portrayed by the commercial milk formula industry as pathological and framed as reasons to introduce formula, when in fact these behaviors are common and developmentally appropriate. However, manufacturers claim their products can alleviate discomfort or improve nighttime sleep, and also infer that formula can enhance brain development and improve intelligence, all of which are unsubstantiated. Infant feeding is further commodified by cross-promotion of infant, follow-on, toddler, and growing-up milks using the same branding and numbered progression, which aims to build brand loyalty and is a blatant attempt to circumvent legislation that prohibits advertising of infant formula. Breastfeeding has proven health benefits across high-income and low-income settings alike. It reduces childhood infectious diseases, mortality, and malnutrition, and the risk of later obesity. Mothers who breastfed have decreased risk of breast and ovarian cancers, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. However, less than 50% of babies worldwide are breastfed, according to World Health Organization recommendations, resulting in economic losses of nearly $350 billion each year. Meanwhile, the commercial milk formula industry generates revenues of about $55 billion annually, with about $3 billion spent on marketing activities every year. The industry's dubious marketing practices are compounded by lobbying, often covertly via trade associations and front groups, against strengthening breastfeeding protection laws and challenging food standard regulations. In 1981, the World Health Assembly adopted the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, a set of standards to prevent inappropriate marketing of formula. It includes prohibition of advertising of commercial milk formula to the public or promotion within healthcare systems, banning provision of free samples to mothers, healthcare workers, and health facilities, no promotion of formula within health services, and no sponsorship of health professional or scientific meetings by the commercial milk formula industry. However, despite repeated calls for governments to incorporate the code's recommendations into legislation, only 32 countries have legal measures that substantially align with the code. A further 41 countries have legislation that moderately aligns with the code, and 50 have no legal measures at all. As a result, the code is regularly flouted without penalty. The prioritization of trade interests over health was brought into the forefront in 2018 when U.S. officials threatened to enforce trade sanctions and withdraw military aid to Ecuador unless it dropped a proposed resolution at the World Health Assembly to protect and promote breastfeeding. Wow. Militarization over breastfeeding. Yikes. Some commercial milk formula lobby groups have cautioned against improved parental leave. Duration of paid maternity leave is correlated with breastfeeding prevalence and duration. An absence of or inadequate paid leave forces many mothers to return to work soon after childbirth. Lack of safe spaces for breastfeeding or expressing milk in workplaces or facilities to store breast milk mean that breastfeeding is not a viable option for many women. Some women choose not to breastfeed or are unable to, perceive pressure or inability to breastfeed, especially if it is at odds with the mother's wishes, can have a detrimental effect on mental health, and systems should be in place to fully support all mothers in their choices. Women and families make decisions about infant feeding based on the information they receive, and a criticism of the commercial milk formula industry's predatory marketing practices should not be interpreted as a criticism of women. All information that families receive on infant feeding must be accurate and independent of industry influence to ensure informed decision-making. Marketing by the commercial milk formula industry is an interconnected, multifaceted, powerful system that knowingly explodes parents' aspirations. Under the Convention of the Rights of the Child, governments have a duty to tackle misinformation, and governments need to embrace the breastfeeding code without further delay to ensure that manufacturers making misleading claims about their products are held to account. You know, this has been a decades-long fight. I mean, I remember in the 80s when I was doing my graduate study in public health nutrition, and this was a huge issue when Nestle was the big-time producer worldwide, and particularly in third-world countries where people don't even have access to clean water, breastfeeding is particularly a health boost because if you're putting unclean water to mix up formula, you increase diarrheal diseases, which is a leading killer of infants. We have a long way to go still.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I want to conclude this nutrition series and the last regular reporting in this episode on nutrition from my favorite nutrition website for getting concise and accurate information, nutritionfacts.org. And this one addresses the holy grail of cheese. This article entitled Cheese and the Comparison Challenge. When studies funded by industry suggest their products have neutral health effects or even beneficial, one question you always have to ask is, compared to what? Is cheese healthy? Compared to what? If you're sitting down to make a sandwich, cheese is probably healthy if you compare it to bologna. But what if you compare it to peanut butter? No way. That's the point made by Walter Willett, former co-chair at Harvard. To conclude that dairy foods are neutral could be misleading, as many would interpret this to mean that increasing consumption of dairy foods would have no effect on cardiovascular disease or mortality. Lost is the health effects of increasing or decreasing consumption of dairy foods could depend importantly on the specific foods that are substituted for dairy foods. Think about what we'd put in your salad. Cheese would be healthy compared to bacon, but not compared to nuts. For example, consumption of nuts or plant protein has been inversely associated, that is, protectively associated with risk of coronary heart disease and type 2 diabetes. In contrast, intake of red meat has been positively associated with these adverse outcomes. Thus, it is reasonable to assume that the lack of association with dairy foods puts these somewhere in the middle of the spectrum of healthiness, but not an optimal source of energy or protein. More broadly, the available evidence supports policies that limit dairy production and encourages production of healthier sources of proteins and fats. Willett wasn't just speculating. His statements were based on three famous Harvard studies involving hundreds of thousands of men and women exceeding 5 million person years of follow-up. What was learned in the first large-scale prospective study to examine dairy fat intake compared to other types of fat in relation to heart attack and stroke risk. Replacing about 100 calories worth of fat from cheese with 100 calories worth of fat from peanut butter on a daily basis might reduce risk up to 24%, whereas substitution with other animal fats might make things worse. Swapping dairy fat for vegetable oil would be associated with a decrease in disease risk, whereas swapping dairy for meat increases risk. Calories from dairy fat may be as bad as or even worse than straight sugar. The lowest risk would entail replacing dairy fat with a whole plant food like whole grains. Yes, dairy products are also a major contributor to the saturated fat in the diet and have thus been targeted as one of the main dietary causes of cardiovascular disease, the number one killer of men and women. But the dairy industry likes to argue that there are other components of dairy products, like fermentation, byproducts, and cheese, that could counteract the effects of their saturated fat. This is all part of an explicit campaign by the dairy industry to, quote, neutralize the negative image of milk fat among regulators and health professionals as related to heart disease. If the Global Dairy Platform looks familiar to you, you may recall it as one of the funders of the Milk and Dairy is Neutral study, trotting out their dairy is fat countered notion, to which the American Heart Association responded that, quote, no information from controlled studies supports the hypothesis that fermentation adds beneficial nutrients to cheese that counteract the harmful effects of its saturated fat. We need to cut down on dairy, meat, coconut oil, and the like, no matter what their respective industries say. In fact, that's the reason the American Heart Association felt it needed to release a special presidential advisory in 2017. It wanted to set the record straight on why well-conducted scientific research overwhelmingly supports limiting saturated fat in the diet. Everything we eat has an opportunity cost. Every time we put something in our mouth, it's a lost opportunity to eat something even healthier. And I would recommend for all of your nutrition interests, go to nutritionfacts.org. If you want to look up dairy, you can find some really interesting short videos that will talk about other ways that the dairy association and dairy industry has done bad science to promote their own commercial interests. Okay, well, that brings us to the closing feature of the show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. Have 25 bonus articles this week. Couple interesting ones to start out with. Number one, bird flu spreads to new countries, threatens nonstop war on poultry. So it looks like bird flu has become endemic, certainly in the U.S. and in many places around the world. So rather than having to worry about big bird flu outbreaks largely in the spring, which was typically brought about by migrating birds, they're in all kinds of bird populations, and apparently they're there to stay, which is going to be a, quote, nonstop war on poultry. So that industry could really suffer. And in a very interesting tandem article to pair up with that, article number two, a virus crippled U.S. cities 150 years ago. It didn't infect humans, rather horses. So just tie that one together because it really gives an example that human life and quality of life and as well as health is tied to animal populations. And in this case, it wiped out horses. And there was a 3 or 4 weeks where horses was the major transportation at that point in human history. And it just had a massive effect. Now, that was relatively short period of time, a huge effect. This, quote, war on poultry with the bird flu is probably something that's going to continue for a long time and could be a real challenge for the poultry industry. Okay, and some similar stories. Bonus article three, surveillance report shows rise in multi-drug resistant salmonella from food animals. So again, this is all kinds of animals, whether it's chickens or turkey or pork or beef, multi-drug resistant salmonella is going up, becoming more and more prevalent. Bonus article four, animal viruses jump to humans much more often than originally thought. How this changes preparing for the next pandemic. So previously it was thought that you'd get these changes in viruses in animal populations, and then through whatever mechanism, you know, Darwinian luck or whatever, you'd get one that could jump to humans and then you'd start potentially a pandemic. But it looks like actually animal viruses jump to humans quite a bit. And they often just, you know, maybe infect a few people and they may do it repeatedly. So you're actually getting kind of a pool of these animal viruses that are also present in humans. And so they can be changing while they're in humans too, as well as primarily in animals. So the bottom line is, it changes the way that we look at this. It offers actually some opportunities as well, as because you really have another stage to kind of look for preventing a pandemic. It's not simply preventing jumps from animals to humans, but dealing with the fact is what happens when those viruses get into humans. And the fact that it actually is not that uncommon per incident, it's not nearly as dangerous, but because it's present in the humans, we need to study that a lot more. Okay, and another sort of related article, bonus five, scientists in Global South most likely to save us from the next pandemic. So often all the cred goes to a lot of the global north, you know, about all the scientific muscle and all this kind of thing. But actually the scientists in the global south are the ones that are really doing the research that's going to, and surveillance, that's potentially going to save us from the next pandemic. So go global south, give them some credit. Six, kind of a follow-up on that Ohio train derailment. The Ohio train derailment underscores the dangers of the plastics boom. As the petrochemical industry grows, the disaster is a reminder of the health and safety risks that accompany reliance on fossil fuels. One of the bottom lines is it's probably easier to reduce plastic use than it is to increase train safety, although train safety has been going down, so there's definitely opportunities to improve it. Switching gears a little bit, doing a couple abortion stories. Seven, dissatisfaction with abortion policy, highest since 2000. So if you're interested in that survey details, take a look. Eight, post-Roe, Native Americans face even more abortion hurdles. And this is partly because Native Americans, the Native Americans that are located on their own lands, are actually in the midst of a lot of red states. So often they're reliant upon going to red states to get abortions, and since red states are limiting it, they're more disproportionately affected than other Americans. Article 9. High drug prices are not justified by industry's research and development spending, argue experts. And this is nothing new. This has been proven over and over again. But just as a reminder, if you want to take a look at the reasons why that's true, they actually spent more money on stock buybacks than they did on research. So they know that their industry is so ridiculously profitable that rather than actually doing their industry of creating new drugs, just reinvesting in themselves is more profitable. Kind of crazy. Okay, bonus article 10. Doctors are disappearing from emergency rooms as hospitals look to cut costs. So this is causing a bit of a problem because you're reducing the expertise of doctors. It does offer an interesting thing because you're losing some mid-level practitioners like nurse practitioners and physician assistants and that kind of thing. But if you look at studies about actually cutting out the doctors, it definitely does reduce the quality of care there. So got to do something besides just cut costs. You have to look at what the actual product is that you're producing. Bonus article 11. Patients still have no protection against surprise ambulance bills, and there's no solution in sight. So this is another example of, you know, there was a surprise bill that was passed by Congress, but it has a lot of loopholes in it, and this is one. And this just, I mean, it breaks my heart because this is right at the point when people are most vulnerable and least likely to find out what the inexpensive way to go is. You pretty much are, you know, just to the fates of whoever's going to pick you up and take you wherever. But if you're interested in looking at that and maybe learning a couple things to what to do in case you need an ambulance ride, check out that article. Bonus article 12. Nearly 80% of women with breast cancer face financial toxicity. Just another example that is bad enough having to face healthcare problems, but when along with it you have to face financial ruin, just adds to the stress and interferes with recovery from health issues. Bonus article 13. Cost of getting sick for older people of color is 25% higher than for white Americans. Another example of racism, and in some instances, the high cost of being poor. Article 14. Scientific institutions must embrace anti-racist policies, the National Academy's report urges. Article 15, now for sale, data on your mental health gained from telehealth and therapy apps. So people are making money on selling the data. Need some, definitely some regs around that to control and protect people's privacies. Bonus article 16, the best way to boost workers' mental health is give them good managers. So this is a very interesting intervention, so to speak, a public health intervention for mental health is getting good managers, but also it's a good example of the way social determinants of health work. Most people probably wouldn't have in their list of top 100 things to do of having good managers as a public health intervention, but so many people spend so much of their time at work and their work life is a big driver of their mental health that having good managers makes a difference. And this study in particular showed that while bad managers are really bad for your mental health, that actually good managers and the proportion of managers that are really good managers and not that high, it represents a real opportunity to get boosts from mental health from what we currently are by promoting good management techniques of managers, as well as preventing the worst of the worst. Another mental health article, Article 17, how empathetic engagement can increase access to mental health care. So this is kind of a more widespread kind of community worker kind of access thing. You can actually recruit people who have an aptitude for empathetic engagement and have those skills, perhaps have worked on one in their lives and successfully done that. So you can screen and get those workers to provide kind of entry-level access to mental health care, because since we have such strains on our mental health care capabilities, these folks could provide a very good layer of kind of introduction in the mental health care system and would work for a lot of people, but then they just need to have the ability to be able to up the game to a higher level mental health care provider if needed. But also gets to the example that something as simple as empathetic engagement, whether it's from a formal mental health care provider or just a friend or loved one, can have a big impact on our mental health. Bonus Article 18. Indoor pollutant concentrations are significantly lower in homes without a gas stove. So this is my ongoing reporting on what now seems to be a culture war about gas stoves. The right wing wants to protect your right to be able to use a more polluting stove. But it definitely bumps up indoor air pollutant concentrations, especially important for asthma, although indoor air pollutant thing has to do with a lot of health effects, you know, heart disease, cancer, the whole works. But asthma is one of those that immediately is affected. Article 19, beyond Medicare and Social Security, cutting Medicaid after the pandemic would be political madness. Well, and Medicaid is going to be cut in the sense that when the COVID emergency ends, that a lot of people are going to be dropped from Medicaid. But there's also the cost-cutting discussions, negotiations that are happening in Congress don't necessarily get as much attention for Medicaid because Medicare and Social Security are more prominent. And all three of Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid are all politically very popular. Just don't get quite as much attention to Medicaid. So this is a good backgrounder on that. Article 20. Long COVID now looks like a neurological disease, helping doctors to focus treatments. And in a related article, bonus article 21, the haunting brain science of long COVID. And another related article, bonus article 22, the future of long COVID. The emergency is not about to end. So this is ongoing reality. First of all, there are millions and millions of Americans who have long COVID, but also it seems that even with a pretty good population level of immunity, you know, new cases of long COVID are still happening. And it's a very good reason, perhaps one of the most important reasons, to try to avoid infection, because long COVID can be nasty. And part of the nastiness has to do that when it affects our nervous system, you can have very long-term serious consequences. Okay, let's do the last three articles that are little more personal health, a little more perhaps good news. 23, have more sex, please. Basically getting at it can be good for your health. And one of the angles in this article is that we're enduring a lot of social isolation, which is increasing actually in our society and culture, and that sex is a way to connect with people, and sex can be actually good for your health for a lot of reasons, but that's one of them. Article 24, can food be medicine? Will insurers cover it? And other big questions about a new health movement. So the food as medicine thing is actually a good movement. I find it a little annoying because I see food mostly as prevention, whereas medicine is more about treatment. Certainly food can be used as treatment. And I encourage the medical care system to develop medically tailored meals and give food prescriptions and blah, blah, blah. But I'd also like to see our medical system and our social service system be able to give prescriptions for like adequate housing, et cetera, that are also huge social determinants for health. And last up, but not least, bonus article 25. Want to live a longer life? Try eating and living like a centenarian. That's people who live to 100 or above. And this looks basically at the great amount of research that we have on so-called blue zones, which are areas of the world where people are much more likely to live to 100 or beyond. Diet is a big part of that, but also exercise and social connection is very important. You can view these and all the articles and all the previous articles I've ever reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.